Good morning. Welcome back. So today we're going to introduce Feynman diagrams. So what I hope to convince you is that Feynman diagrams are an entirely equivalent way to compute matrix elements or time-ordered vacuum expectation values to what we did in the last two lectures. The reason we introduced them is that in practice they're much faster and easier to use once you get used to them. But they're entirely equivalent to what we've done before. So our plan for today is basically to trace what we did backwards over the last several lectures. So as I've drawn several times before, so what we mostly are interested in computing are matrix elements and relate those to time-ordered products of Heisenberg fields. Which are also interesting objects in their own right. So we'll learn how to compute both of these things using Feynman diagrams. And as we saw last time, it can be related to time-ordered products of interaction picture or free fields, which can also be related to the Feynman propagator. So these are the more interesting objects built out of these simpler objects. And what we're going to do is build these up going backwards. And we'll develop Feynman rules for each of these things in turn. So the simplest object in our line of reasoning that we were computing the matrix elements related to the Heisenberg expectation values, which is related to the free expectation values, which is related to the Feynman propagator. So this is the simplest object. We could compute that. You did most of the computation in the tutorial. And so the natural way to draw a Feynman diagram representing the Feynman propagator to point from point x to y, almost simplest thing you could do, is just draw a line from x to y. So this is our simplest Feynman diagram, and it just represents the Feynman propagator. And so starting from this idea that the Feynman propagator can be represented by a line, what we're going to do is try to figure out both what types of diagrams we should draw to represent these other objects, those first expectation values like this, then expectation values of Heisenberg fields, and finally matrix elements. So which diagrams contribute, and what else do we have to do? So these formulas involve the Feynman propagator, but there were extra integrals, extra numerical factors, and coupling constants, and so we'll figure out how to put those back, so which diagrams to draw, and what the extra ingredients are, and our result will be known as the Feynman rules. So the Feynman rules are prescriptions for which diagrams to draw if you're interested in computing a particular object, whether that's a matrix element or a vacuum expectation value of a time-ordered product of fields, and how to associate an analytic expression to each diagram. So we'll go through that basically in reverse. Okay, so let's start with the simplest object, or second simplest object. The simplest one is the Feynman propagator. We've already determined the Feynman rules. It's simple, just draw a line. So the next simplest object we could consider would be a time-ordered product of, say, four free fields. And so we're calling our results from last time that you reviewed in your homework, that if we have a time-ordered product of free fields, we can relate it to a normal-ordered product of free fields using Wick's theorem. And Wick's theorem tells us that the time-ordered product is just the normal-ordered sum of all of the normal-ordered products of the attractions. And so if we have four fields here, we write them out explicitly, there are three possible ways we can contract them. We can contract one with two, and that forces us to contract three with four. We could also contract one with three, that forces us to contract two with four. Or we could take the other possibility, contract one with four and two with three. So there's three possible contractions. And only the fully contracted terms, three possible fully contracted terms, only the fully contracted terms will survive the vacuum expectation value. So this is just the sum of three terms like this. And also, this is not very hard to draw Feynman diagrams representing this. All we've got here is the product of two propagators in each term. And so we get Feynman diagrams like this. And here, 1, 2, 3, and 4 represent, so 1 means x sub 1. So here we're, and as before, delta 1, 2 is delta f of x1 minus x2. Just using shorthand notation here. Okay, so nothing terribly surprising so far, or terribly much more involved than what we did before. But I just want to make a comment here about the way I've drawn the diagrams that I suggest you follow. So when we're computing these other objects, we'll often be interested, well, our Feynman rules are going to tell us to compute all diagrams of a certain type. And so if we just look at these diagrams, it's easy to tell that they're all different. They all just look physically I've drawn them differently. And that's because I've kept the external particles or external points that show up in our expectation value in the same point in each diagram. So I suggest you do that. So then you can tell just by looking if diagrams are the same or different. So that's basically my only comment on computing this thing. So Wick's theorem just tells us there's going to be a bunch of, we just connect. Basically, we're connecting all of the external points, all the, when I say external point, I just mean the points that show up in our correlation function, in our vacuum expectation value. Just all possible ways of connecting them in pairs. That's just a graphical way of representing Wick's theorem. Okay. So these two were not very difficult. So let's go on to the more interesting and also more non-trivial object, the vacuum expectation value of a time-ordered product of Heisenberg fields. So this is an object that will be interesting in its own right. We'll study this object more in QFD2. We've seen one application is that we need to compute this object, compute the matrix element. So let's see how we can compute this object in using Feynman diagrams. So the simplest such object is the two-point function. So we have two fields in the Heisenberg picture. And the result of last lecture was that we can write this as time-ordered product in the interaction picture. Exponential I times the integral of the interaction Lagrangian divided by same thing without any fields and so here we just have a ratio of ratio of terms. So let's look at them individually. So first, let's look at the numerator. So in the numerator, we can expand out. Expanding out the exponential. So the first term is just going to look like this. Second term will have a factor of I times the integral of the interaction Lagrangian. Let's make a specific choice to simplify things. And so it can be a little more explicit. Let's choose L int B minus lambda pi to the 4. Over 4 factorial. So here then we get a factor of minus I lambda over 4 factorial times the integral before y of pi to the 4 of y. And then we'd have more terms. Keep going. Okay, so this first term, very simple to represent with the Feynman diagram. This is just the Feynman propagator. So this is just a line going from one. And so the next term is the more interesting one. So let's look at that. So we've got phi 1, phi 2, minus I lambda over 4 factorial, integral d4 y, phi 4 y. And so if we want to compute this, again, we can use Wick's theorem. Wick's theorem tells us that the only terms that will survive will be the completely contracted ones. So we need to figure out all the possible ways to contract these six fields. But four of them are the same. Four of them are all at the point y. So there are a bunch of possible ways we can do this. So one is if we could contract phi 1 and phi 2. And if we do that, then we're forced to contract the phi y's among themselves. So there are, we can try the first phi y, there's three possible phi y's, contract the second, just contract it with, and then we're forced to contract the other two among themselves. And so there are three contractions like that. Draw that in orange. three contractions. That. And so then we have delta 1, 2, and the integral of delta yy squared. So this is the same kind of counting you did in the statistical mechanics course on Tuesday. There's a very close analogy between what we're doing here and what you did there. And so that's one possible contraction we could have. The other possible contractions, type of contraction, would be if we contract one of the phi ones with one of the phi y's. There are four possible ways to do that. Four choices here. Then we're forced to contract the phi 2 with one of the phi y's. There's three left. So there's three left. And then we contract the last two among themselves. So here, for the other type of contraction, we get a 12. Minus I lambda over 4 factorial. Delta 1. Everything's inside the integral this time. Integral of delta 1y, delta 2y, delta yy. Okay. So in terms of diagrams, we can represent this as the sum of two diagrams. So our first term here has a propagator from 1 to 2, a propagator from y to y, and a second propagator from y to y, and represented by this diagram. So this is all a single diagram, even though it's not connected. And then our other diagram has 1 going to y, 2 going to y, and y going to y. And like before, I've drawn the external points here, 1 and 2, in the same relative position in both diagrams. The internal points can move around. That's okay. That shouldn't affect whether you two diagrams look the same or not. It's not always a diagrams tend to look ugly if you keep the internal points at the same point. Okay. So this is what the numerator looks like. We'll come back to the denominator in a second, but let's just try to guess the Feynman rules that will give us the terms in the numerator. So this will be our first set of Feynman rules. So we have there'll be relations between Feynman rules for different objects, but in general, if we're computing a different object, we need to use usually a slightly different version of the Feynman rules. So keep in mind when people say the Feynman rules, they're usually implicitly assuming you're calculating one particular object, most often the matrix element. But if we're interested in computing this, we'll look at a different but related version of the Feynman rules. So here is our first set of Feynman rules. It'll be the Feynman rules for the numerator, which is not the most interesting object in itself. In practice, we're only ever going to be interested in this ratio, but I'm going to collect the Feynman rules for the numerator here because we'll see that the Feynman rules for the ratio are going to take a very similar form. So just to collect what we've done so far in a self-contained way and illustrate where the Feynman rules, various aspects of the Feynman rules come from in the simplest possible context. Okay. So what we've seen, well, we'll just try to generalize our experience so far. So let's suppose we want to compute the numerator, which takes this form in general. And so one thing we notice is that, well, both of our zeroth order term and our first order term involve two external points. If we added more and more higher order terms from the exponential, we'd get more and more integrals over internal points. But the number of external points with specific labels that are not integrated over is fixed. So here, all of our diagrams are going to have two external points. So what we're going to do, we'll sum over this, over all diagrams. With n external points. And well, we see that we can have our zeroth order term, where we didn't expand the exponential, just like the constant piece, had no vertices. So this point here is a vertex, involves four fields meeting at the same point. We can get one vertex from expanding the exponential to first order. If we expand it to any to arbitrarily high order, we can get arbitrarily many vertices. So we can get basically diagrams that contain any number of internal vertices. So this will be the sum with a fixed number of external points and any number of internal vertices. So those are the diagrams we expect to contribute to this. Okay, so that's one aspect of the Feynman rules, is which diagrams we need to consider. The other aspect is, how do we recover, once we've drawn the diagram, these are not just pretty pictures, we want to use them to compute things. So we want to be able to, once we've drawn a diagram, be able to associate back to it some analytic expression. So, our first rule is basically the same as how we determined which diagrams to draw. We said that the Feynman diagram, Feynman propagator, is associated with a line. So if we have a line, it's a Feynman propagator. So for each line from x to y, we get Feynman propagator from x to y. Our second rule is going to be trivial in this case. Based on what we've done so far, there's absolutely no reason for me to write it down, but I'm just going to do it so you don't forget it when you're dealing with particles with spin. So there's a non-trivial rule here that Gong will tell you all about, involving external points. So for external points, well, there's nothing special that shows up in our expressions for external points. There will be when you deal with particles with spin. So I'm writing this here so you remember that. Our next Feynman rule has to do with the vertices. So we notice that in these expressions, every time we have a vertex, those vertices come from expanding out the exponential. When we expand out the exponential, not only do we get four fields at the same point, we also get a factor of minus I times the coupling constant. Coupling constant lambda, and an integral. So we get both an integral and a minus I lambda. Okay, so this rule in the form I've written it is specific to the particular theory we're considering. We're considering here a interaction Lagrangian that had four of the same type of fields at the same point. More generally, we might be interested in other types of interactions. And well, we can generalize this rather easily if we just assume that the interaction Lagrangian contains a term that's a polynomial in our fields. So it has a term minus g times, let's just say it's involves three types of fields, verify, regular phi, and psi, to some powers, normalized in a particular way. Then there will be a vertex that involves n1 phi lines. n2 regular phi lines, and n3 psi lines. And this will just be equal to minus g times the integral. That's what we get for the vertex. And then, well, we almost got what we want. We've got the factors, we've got the Feynman propagators, we've got the integrals. Only one thing we're missing, and that's the overall numerical factor. So you notice here in the third Feynman rule, I did not include this n factorial, 4 factorial in this case. And that's because it's much easier to deal with the factorials in our interaction Lagrangian and the factors from the Wick interactions simultaneously. So the last step is divide by the symmetry factor. And so S is defined, symmetry factor S, defined to be the number of ways a diagram can be mapped to itself with, and this is important, the external points held fixed. And so 1 over S is equal to the number of Wick contractions divided by the factorials in L. So this is basically a combinatorial identity. I'm not going to prove it, but I'm just going to demonstrate that it works in a few simple cases. And the reason that I'm suggesting that you get used to calculating the symmetry factors of diagrams instead of the Wick contractions, which you can in principle do based on what we learned in Tuesday's class, is that, well, in practice, most often, S is a small integer, usually 1 or 2. And so there's usually a lot of wood contractions, and calculating, while it's straightforward in practice, it usually takes longer to calculate the number of wood contractions than the symmetry factor. With a bit of practice, you'll just be able to look at a diagram and see its symmetry factor. When you're just starting out, I suggest you check, go back and check a few times so you're doing counting things correctly. And so what types of symmetries should you be looking for? So you can look for exchanges of external ends of internal lines. Lines or vertices. We'll see some examples where these kinds of symmetries give us ways that we can map a Feynman diagram to itself, keeping the external lines fixed. So let's just check in these two simple cases that we get the correct overall numerical factor. So we counted already using wick contractions. Let's count again using symmetry. So for this diagram, if the external lines are held fixed, then this line is different from this line. So the only symmetry we have is basically of this internal propagator from Y to Y. So we can basically flip it around, and that doesn't change the diagram. So this has you can think of that if you like, as exchanging the ends of the Y to Y propagator. So this diagram has a symmetry factor of S equals 2. And let's check we get the same factor. So from wick contractions, we got 12 over 4 factorial, which is just 1/2 or 1 over our symmetry. So we do get the same overall numerical factor. Tried the other diagram. Is disconnected, this diagram. Okay, so this diagram has a larger symmetry factor. We can think of the symmetry factor as we've got two Y to Y propagators. So we get a factor of 2 times for each of them from exchanging the ends of the lines. And we can also switch the X and Y, the Y to Y propagator on top with the Y to Y propagator on bottom. So these two from exchanging the ends, and this one from exchanging lines. So our symmetry factor is 8. And we had from wick contractions 3 over 12 factorial, which indeed is 1 over 8, so it works in both cases.
Can you explain how the exchanging ends?
So this for this diagram, we can. So one way to think about it is if we reflect this top line over itself, over the axis of symmetry, that tells us there's basically two different versions. We can map this, or we can also think about that as if we imagine this was a we could break that symmetry by imagining this was a directed propagator from y to y, and it wouldn't matter if we think about this particle as propagating this way around the loop or that way around the loop. It's the same thing. So there's a symmetry factor of two. And down here, we can basically just repeat that argument for each of these lines independently. We could reverse the direction of propagation on each line independently. Which it doesn't matter which way it's propagating, that's why it's symmetric. And we can also flip which one we drew on top and which one we drew on the bottom. So that's each of those gives us a factor.
What's 12 factorial from?
It's 4 factorial.
4 factorial, sorry.
So then I have a question about that. I mean, isn't that super artificial? Because don't you build in the 4 factorial when you make your 5-fold theory?
Yes. You can think about the reason that we put this 4-factorial here is so that the Feynman rules take the simple form.
Right.
It's a choice of normalization.
But like, if I was making a theory, I would have to know that before. I can never use this theorem, basically, unless I...
You can, as long as... So the cases we'll be interested in for near future are cases where our interactions are polynomials in fields. So as long as you normalize your fields like this, so if you have n1 copies of one field, divide by n factorial, and similarly for the other fields, then the Feynman rule number 3 will always just be factor minus I times the coupling. And the symmetry factor counting will work. Identity that 1 over the symmetry factor is the number of Witt contractions divided by the factorial is connected to this fact, because the basic diagram in this theory has basically a symmetry factor of 4 factorial. So that's why that identity works, and that's why this is a good choice of normalization. And we'll basically always choose that normalization. So if you didn't, you could still make this work. It would be you'd have to go through this whole procedure every single time. As long as you remember that normalization, it's easy to guess what the Feynman rule should be. New theory. And we'll look at a bunch of different theories in tutorial this afternoon. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we've looked at the numerator. The next thing to look at is the denominator. I think Pedro told you a bit about this on Tuesday. And I'll go through it again, maybe in a slightly different way. So our denominator is just the time-ordered exponential with no extra fields. And we can think about this as a special case of what we looked at before with n equals 0. So if we expand this out, just get 1 plus time ordered minus I lambda over 4 factorial, roll d4y, y to 4y, so on. And basically, it's of the same form as we looked at before, just n equals 0. So we're looking at diagrams with no external points and any number of vertices. So we can go to arbitrarily high order if we're interested in lots of vertices. But the low order terms are just going to be the terms of the few vertices. And so there's no good way to draw this first term, the one term. So I'll just write that as one. And then our first order term, we have to contract all of the y's with themselves. So we'll get a diagram like this. At next order, we'll have two vertices, and we would need to look at all the possible diagrams we can draw with two vertices. So one possible diagram we could get is if we contract. So this will come from contractions of phi to the 4y with phi to the 4z. So we could contract all the y's among themselves, all the z's among themselves to get this diagram. This is a single diagram. We could also contract two of the y's with two of the z's and get something like this. Or we could contract all the y's with all the z's. And that's all we get at that order. We could add more vertices, get more diagrams. So one thing to notice is that this diagram looks like the square of this diagram. And in fact, this diagram is equal to 1/2 of the square of this diagram. And that's because if we just compute this diagram, this figure 8 diagram, we've already seen that it has a symmetry factor of 8. So if we compute this diagram, it'll have a symmetry factor, or square 8 will have a symmetry factor of 64. But if we look at this as a single diagram, we've got a symmetry factor of 8 from each individual part. We also have a symmetry factor of 2 from exchanging them. So to write this as a square of a single diagram, we need to account for that extra exchange of the two sub-diagrams. And so this term, well, it looks like we're getting the first few terms in the exponential of this diagram, which is not surprising because we started with an exponential. So maybe there's a way we can reorganize the series as an exponential. And in fact, we can do that. Pedro told you about this, so we can write this as the exponential, in fact, of all of the connected diagrams, connected vacuum diagrams. So, of course, the sum contains any number of disconnected diagrams, but any disconnected diagram can be constructed from products of connected diagrams, possibly with additional symmetry factors, if we have repeated subdiagrams. But we've seen, at least in this case, that the exponential takes care of the extra symmetry factors, and that'll work in general. Not just for this particular case. So in fact, this denominator is the exponential connected vacuum diagrams. And when I computed the numerator the first time, we also saw vacuum diagrams. And we said that the numerator was the sum of all diagrams with n external points. Well, any diagram with n external points is going to be some part that's connected to the external points times some vacuum diagrams. So we can write the numerator as something like this times the sum of the connected of all the vacuum diagrams. which is the same exponential of connected vacuum diagrams. So if we're interested in computing the time-ordered expectation value of Heisenberg fields, we want to compute the ratio of the numerator and denominator. This exponential cancels. And so what we're left with is just the diagrams with vacuum diagrams removed. So we can very simply modify our Feynman rules for the numerator to get the Feynman rules for the vacuum expectation value of Heisenberg fields. And basically, the only thing that changes is that instead of summing all diagrams, we need to sum all diagrams with no vacuum subdiagrams.
Good. Can you explain again when we can factor the numerator?
That's general. So the argument I gave, and you can make this more precise to make sure that the non-trivial thing is checking that the numerical factors work out. But the observation that suggests that is that if we have a general a general diagram. Suppose we're looking at a two-point diagram. We can draw that as maybe some complicated thing times some combination of vacuum diagrams. So this could be one diagram. And we can always break up any diagram, no matter how complicated it is, into some part that's connected to the external points, times some part that contains vacuum diagrams. And the claim is that, in fact, it's stronger than that. Not only do we can we always break up any individual diagram like that, but we will get the correct overall numerical factor if we multiply them out like that. I'm not going to show that, but that's a true statement. Okay.
And how do we know that something is a vacuum subdiagram? Like, is there a way of telling this right away by looking at something?
Yes. So a vacuum subdiagram just means that it's not connected to any external point. So in this example over here, I have two external points. So from any points here, I can, by following Feynman propagators, get to one of the external points. So this part is the part this contains no vacuum subdiagrams. And these parts here are vacuum subdiagrams, because from any part of this diagram, there's no way, by following the lines, to get to one of the two external points. So something like this is connected. Is not connected, but does not contain any vacuum subdiagrams. So if these are 1, 2, 3, and 4, there's no way to get from this point to 3, but I can get to some external point. So this counts as not containing vacuum subdiagrams. Okay. So this part So maybe in a different language is equivalent to, I think, what you did on Tuesday. I think here's a good place to take a break. And after break, we'll go a bit farther than you did in that step mech and look at how to compute matrix elements using Feynman diagrams. And so we know how to compute this using Feynman diagrams. We know which diagrams contribute and how to assign an analytic expression to each diagram. So part of lecture, we're going to see what this formula tells us about which diagrams contribute to this object and how we can associate an analytic expression for each of those diagrams. And from looking at this formula, we can guess some of the features of the answer. So we're taking a Fourier transform. So our Feynman diagrams over here are going to be in momentum space. So we expect things to be written in terms of the Fourier transform of the Feynman propagator. We also have here a bunch of Klein-Gordon operators. And as we saw on Tuesday, the Klein-Gordon operator acting on the Feynman propagator gives us a delta function. So this is going to remove some of the deltas. And so one thing we'll need to keep in mind here that I'll have more to say about tomorrow is that this is the physical mass here. So keep that in mind. So let's by looking at some simple examples, try to see if we can guess how this works in general. So the case we're most often interested in the simplest case, or these amplitudes is the 2-to-2 scattering. So the natural thing to look at here is the four-particle, four-field vacuum expectation value. So let's look at that, which we already examined earlier in lecture. Four fields. At leading order, that just gives us these three diagrams. And we could go to higher order. So these contain no vertices, therefore no copies of the coupling constant. So these would be the leading diagrams. We could add more vertices and go to higher order if we wanted to. But let's just, for simplicity, see what these diagrams give us if we plug them into the LSE formula. And let's look at them one at a time. So this diagram here, according to our Feynman rules, is delta 1-3 times delta 2-4. Very simple expression. So one thing to notice is that this diagram factorizes product of two things. And so does everything else here. So we're doing integrals over x1 and x3, derivatives with respect to x1 and x3. And so we can just consider the x1 and x3 parts separately for now. Katie? So in principle, for an interacting theory, the leading contribution to this expectation value is these three diagrams. Interactions would involve vertices, which would be suppressed by the coupling. So you may be asking that question because this doesn't look like scattering. We're interested in scattering here. So that's a very good observation, and we'll in fact see that borne out in our calculations. But it'll be interesting to see exactly how that works. we'll go through that. Yeah, we'll see a bit more than we can just might be able to guess. Okay, so let's give a name to the operators, Klein-Gordon operators with respect to x1 and x3, acting on delta 1,3. And so we'd have a similar thing for 2 and 4. And LSC formula tells us we need to do some integrals of this. So let's do those. I'm just concentrating on the x1 and x3 integrals for now. And to do the integrals, so delta x3, delta 1,3 is a function just of x1 minus x3. So to do the integrals, it'd be convenient to change variables to x1 minus x3. And I'll call x13 be x1 minus x3, x13 bar as x13 x1 plus x3 bar with a minus sign. And I'll do the same thing for the momenta. I'll throw in a factor of 2 for convenience. And then this tells the LSC formula we want to basically take the Fourier transform. So P x1 is an initial particle, so we get a plus sign there, and x3 is final particle, so we get a minus sign. And then here, this is f of x1 minus x3. So after the change of variables, this becomes get a half from the Jacobian. Integral x13, 1,3 bar. I p13 dot x13. Plus p13 bar dot x13, p13 dot x31 bar times f of x13 bar. And now we can do the x13 integral. And the x13 bar integral. So the x13 bar integral is just going to tell us to Fourier transform f. And so we get here the Fourier transform of f of p13. Then we can do the other integral. And we just get, going back to our original variables, a delta of p1 minus p3 times the Fourier transform of f of p1 plus p3 over 2. And the half disappeared because we get a delta of p13 bar, which has a factor of 2. Delta of x over 2 is 2 delta of x. Okay, so that's what we get. And similarly for the other part, for the 2,4 part. And so we see exactly what you'd expect. Which is that the contribution to scattering amplitude from this diagram, that's what this means here. This is just the contribution to this object from this particular diagram. It's not the whole thing. It's proportional to product of two deltas, so P1 minus P3 and a delta P2 minus P4. So the momentum of particle one, which is the incoming particle, is the same as the momentum of particle three, which is an outcoming particle, and the same for two and four. So there's no scattering here, as you'd expect. If you just look at our diagram, it doesn't look like there's any scattering. So that's true. It means we can, at least somewhat more, trust our intuition that we get from these diagrams, which is another useful property of these diagrams. So this diagram represents no scattering. So does this one. This one is strange, involves a delta of P1 plus P2. These are both incoming particles. It's the only way that delta, the argument of that delta could be zero is if P1 plus P2 is zero. But that would mean that the energy of both of those particles is zero in particular, so that's never going to happen for physical scattering. So this is proportional to a delta, which and P1 plus P2 is never zero for physical scattering. So this diagram is just zero. And so we learn that these diagrams have extra deltas compared to what we'd expect. Remember, we expect this to be proportional to an overall momentum conserving delta. And we don't expect, it'd be a terrible property if our theory allowed for scattering that violated energy momentum conservation. After all, we're dealing with a translation invariant theory. But these diagrams have extra deltas. And furthermore, from our argument, we see that nothing really depended on the form of the diagram. All that we really used in this derivation where we got an extra delta was the fact that this f only depended on x1 minus x3. So in fact, our argument shows that any disconnected diagram like this, where not all of the external legs are connected together, will have extra delta functions. And so that's a good property. That's a desirable property. It means that basically this part of the scattering is independent of that part of the scattering, which is related to the clustering or one of the technical ways of stating the locality properties we wanted our theory to have. So that's basically the Fourier transform of the statement that we have well-separated experiments in position space, the results should be independent. So we do two scattering, if we have sub-diagrams that are a disconnected diagram, it has extra deltas. So the results of one part of the diagram doesn't have any influence on the other.
For the second diagram, though, could you explain again why you got a delta of P1 plus P2?
So here, we could basically repeat this argument with, but this diagram is equal to delta 1, 2, delta 3, 4. So the 1, 2 part is separate from the 3, 4 part. Unlike here, it was the 1, 3 part. It was separate from that. So if we repeat the same argument just with the replacement 1 going to 2, we'll also have a difference in the sign here. because they're both incoming. So that will change the sign. And so we'll get a P1 plus P2. And so another thing that this extra deltas tell us is that there's no interference between disconnected diagrams and fully connected diagrams. And that's a key property. Basically, so if the disconnected diagram has an extra delta function, so either the argument of the delta function is zero, in which case the disconnected diagram is infinitely more important, or the argument of the delta is not zero and the disconnected part vanishes. So in either case, it'll be either infinitely larger or infinitely smaller than the connected part, so there's no interference. So if we can, so that means we can just, if we're interested in computing the matrix element, we can just look at connected parts. And if we want to include the contribution from disconnected parts, we can also do that entirely separately. We don't always want to do that because experimentally, it's usually pretty easy to tell if there is scattering or not, or no scattering. So if there's no scattering, so remember that our setup for our experiments is we know the initial momenta and we're measuring the final momenta. If you see that the initial momenta is exactly the same as the final momenta, you know there's no scattering, so there's no real use in calculating that. So in practice, what this calculation is telling us is that we're basically only, these ones are the only interesting ones. And so in those are the only ones we're gonna ever really calculate. And this is a statement about which ones are interesting for the matrix element. Okay, so let's look at the first interesting diagram. Again, in our 5-4 theory. So we need to have a completely connected diagram. And it should have one vertex. There's only one way to draw a completely connected diagram with one vertex, like this. And so if we draw this diagram, if this is a contribution to the time-ordered expectation value, our earlier Feynman rules tell us there's one vertex, there's one factor minus I lambda, and an integral over y. And then the Feynman propagators, delta 1y, delta 2y, delta 3y, delta 4y. Okay, so now we can plug this back into our LSE formula. What we need to do is act with the Klein-Gordon operators and Fourier transform with some signs. So the Klein-Gordon operator acting on Feynman propagator gives us a delta. And so we have four propagators, we've got four Klein-Gordon operators. These operators just remove all of the Feynman propagators, give us four deltas. We can use these to do the x integrals. And so what we're left with is the contribution to the scattering from this diagram. So that's what this notation means. It's not saying that the This is an exact statement. This is just the contribution to this object from this particular diagram. This is minus I lambda. That doesn't change. We had that before. We still have the y integral. We're using the delta to do the x integrals, the four x integrals. And then we've got this exponential with signs depending on whether they're incoming or outgoing. The plus for incoming, minus for outgoing. And then this is an integral we can do. This gives us a delta. So minus I lambda 2 pi to the fourth. And then the overall momentum conserving delta that we expected. So we see that explicitly coming out of our calculations. We'd be very unhappy if it didn't. But this is a reassuring check that what we're doing makes sense. And so remember, the transfer matrix or matrix element was related to the S matrix by pulling out 2 pi to the 4 and overall momentum conserving delta. So then our matrix element, or I times it, is just this coefficient minus I lambda at this order. Okay. So that illustrates what we expect, or basically how the LSC formula tells us what to do to the diagrams we get from this. Heisenberg picture expectation value. We cheated a little bit in this last part. So here, on Tuesday, I told you this equation works. So remember delta F is defined to be the time-ordered expectation value in the free theory or in the interaction picture for the interacting theory. And in both cases, the M should be the M of the free theory, or the unperturbed M. It's the M that shows up in the Lagrangian. So if we act with the Klein-Gordon operator, this equation is true if this M is the M that shows up in the Lagrangian. But the M that shows up here is the physical mass. These are not necessarily the same thing. So this last step is a little bit questionable. It turns out to be correct at leading order. To correct this, and this is something I'll say a bit more about tomorrow. Pedro in a different language said a little bit about this on Tuesday. Is that we want to fix this and deal with this discrepancy. What we should do is amputate our diagrams. So first, let me explain what amputation means and then why we would want to do that. Briefly, I'll justify this more tomorrow. So suppose we've got some complicated diagram. Okay. Complicated enough. So amputation means, so here, these are our external particles. So we can imagine we've got, this is a momentum space. So we've got, in our scattering experiment, we've got particles with momenta P1, P2, P3, P4 coming in and going out. Amputation means taking each of the external legs and chopping it off as far as you can so that you're not affecting its interaction with any other particle. So before you reach any other particle. So in this diagram, we would amputate here, here, and here. Basically, this part of the diagram, this P3 particle is only interacting with itself. It's not interacting with any of the other external particles. So the amputated diagram would look like this. So basically, amputation equals means removing corrections to external legs. And the reason we want to do that is basically, as I'll explain in more detail tomorrow, these corrections to the external legs represent precisely this difference. The corrections to the external legs basically turn the mass of the particle, they change the mass of the particle. They change the mass of the particle from the mass that shows up in the Lagrangian to the mass, the physical mass, the mass measured in the lab. So this accounts for this difference. Okay, so let's collect. Let's take our example and extrapolate and get our set of Feynman rules for the matrix element. Okay. So first of all, we could compute the matrix element, the total matrix element. Often, implicitly, what we're interested in doing is computing the completely connected part. So if we want to do that, then what we should do is we should sum. And we don't have to look at just those, but that's in practice what we're interested in. Completely connected. Amputated diagrams. Okay. And so our Feynman rules, just a bit of extrapolation from the examples we looked at. So our first Feynman rule is for an internal line. We get Fourier transform of the Feynman propagator. So we didn't see that explicitly in our example yet, but shouldn't be that much of a stretch to imagine that since we're Fourier transforming everything, the Feynman propagators that we had before in position space become Feynman propagators in momentum space. For external lines. External line. So again, they're just one. I'm writing this just to remind you not to forget it when Yang tells you about particles with spin. Our third rule for the vertex, get a minus I lambda for our particular theory. For other theories, you just get, in the same way as before, you just get vertices with a number of lines going in corresponding to which type of field you have there, provided you normalize them in this way. Step four. We should impose momentum conservation at each vertex. So here we had one vertex in which all four particles went in, and we saw that we got, basically, we went through what the LSE formula told us to do, told us to basically do some Fourier transforms. After acting with the Klein-Gordon operators, we got a delta function. That will generalize if we've got a bunch of vertices. So for instance, in this diagram, we should impose momentum conservation here, 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 at all the vertices. And as before, so far we'll be missing the overall numerical factor, so we need to divide by the symmetry factor. And so nothing in the LSE formula will change the overall numerical constant in front of each of the diagrams. So this just carries over directly from the position space vacuum expectation value we looked at earlier. The last step is, well, you might, if you look at step four for a diagram like this, so P1 going in, P3 coming out. Well, if we try to use momentum conservation to determine what's the momentum on this line, there's no way to do it. It's underdetermined. So if we assume that the momentum here is k, then that gives us enough information to say that the momentum going this way has to be P1 minus P3 minus k. But it's undetermined, and that is going to show up in our Feynman rules. What we should do, we should integrate over undetermined momentum. For momentum. And one comment is, notice I've drawn the arrows for the momentum next to the diagram, next to the lines instead of on the lines. That's good practice. Arrows on the lines are usually meant to indicate the flow of charge. And so in tutorial today, we'll have some practice using these Feynman diagrams. This is a key tool for studying perturbation theory. And what we're going to do tomorrow is basically we're going to come back to something I mentioned at the end of Monday's lecture, which is the fact that if we want to use the LSE formula, we have to renormalize. So we made some assumptions about the form factor and the vacuum expectation value of the field. So in today's lecture, we've just added a interaction term without worrying about that. And so we'll come back and examine that issue. And we'll see that there's a lot we can say about the interacting theories using the tools of Feynman diagrams without doing very much calculation. So the full machinery of renormalization will postpone to QFT2, but tomorrow we'll see that there's a lot we can do without actually needing to evaluate many of these integrals. So that's where we're going. Any questions? Okay, I'll see you this afternoon.